Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dad's gum government, you sorry so-and-sos. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dad's gum, dad's gum. Government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you get down, get down, get down, government?
Welcome to Handling the Truth. This is Terry Dodd, and a.k.a. Tenacity, and I'm here today with my co-host, Mike Gaddy, also known as the Rebel Madman. You can find his articles at rebelmadman.com. And today we have a special guest. It's really kind of, I call him a guest co-host because he's got as much or more radio talk show experience than Mike and I probably put together, but... welcome to Handling the Truth, Dale.
Well, thank you, TC. It's a rare experience to be a guest. We'll see if this works. I'll try not to pummel you with questions.
Well, just pummel away at Mike. I won't worry about that.
Right. He's used
right,
to that.
So, Dale Williams.
Yeah.
Mike, how about give Dale Williams a proper introduction?
Well, I tell you, I believe, Dale, you can correct me if I'm wrong, what, we've known each other for, what, about 15 years now?
I can remember you saying you were 63 in one of our conversations, so you can date it at least that far back, and you're 64 and a half now, right?
Yes, that is correct. So I've known you about 4 months. Oh, yeah. Well, I remember, I was writing articles for one of those libertarian websites, and one day I got an email from some guy with K-Talk Radio in Salt Lake City. And since I haven't written any articles for that website in 10 years, so it has to be longer than that.
Right.
So if I'm not mistaken, Dale, our very first show, we went into the dynamics of the war with Iraq. Is that not correct?
Well, we spent quite a bit of time on the war in Iraq, and your son was a part of that and came on as my sole guest for a couple hours, he having been there on the ground as a commissioned officer in the Army. And we did some time taking apart the Iraq war.
And if I remember correctly, some of the conversation between you and our son was kind of irritating to certain personnel at the radio station.
I had so much friction, I think, with my radio station that could very well be. I have trouble sorting out which subject irritated them the most, but I think they breathed a sigh of relief when I finally went home.
Well, I give you all the credit in the world, my friend, because I tell you what, I've never seen you back up from anything, and you're willing to take on any subject probably at a level above most of us, and I've always been very appreciative of that, and I've always felt like you don't put enough confidence in your own writing either. You have written some great stuff that you send out to your list.
Yeah, and I've never gone beyond the level of a little victim list that I have, which is my email list. And I see so many talented writers out there that I don't aspire to go beyond that distribution. But of course, it's your writing that got my attention for much the same reason as you've talked about just now, you know, in trying to characterize what I did on the radio. And you were very direct and setting aside of political correctness at all times, but you did it in a way that had a lot of class. And yet, as soon as you touched on the subject of, not to get you off your thread here too much, but I'll never forget, you wrote a very well-mannered, you know, a very tightly reasoned article about noncompliance, about, I guess the term is civil disobedience, and the forum that you're writing for that really made you famous, I think, hit the ejection seat button instantly.
Yeah, and, you know, and what was also strange about that was they basically told me that my services were no longer needed, but, you know, in conjunction with that, the article that I sent in, I was told that I, the namesake of the place said that I was a clarion call for civil disobedience in America, and I told him, well, hell, I thought that's what it was all about. But that, you know, we've had so many of those in our history that I would be happy to be associated with. But I think it was kind of strange, too, that a couple of days after this article, which he refused to publish, a couple of days later, I get a visit from the fine fellows in a black SUV.
Oh, what a, you know, and what a... what an education, that little story, you know, and I don't know where TC wants to take us today, and I guess we have pretty free reign, but, and I don't know if you guys have talked about that particular episode, but as a snapshot, if you had just arrived from another planet and you were shown all of our constitutional guarantees and the supposed basis of our civilization here in the United States, And then we're shown that dialogue between the FBI and yourself. That would be a hell of a compressed education for somebody from off planet, because the box we live in is a pretty small box, and it's a highly disciplined box, if you know what I mean, Mike.
Oh, very much so. I thought it was kind of ironic that the article wasn't published, and yet when they arrived in my driveway, they had a copy.
Right, so Operation Mockingbird and all of its follow-on iterations and tentacles. I mean, the term Mockingbird is very antiquated at this point, but there is a tentacle for every major, connected to every major outlet, news outlet, internet outlet, and it's really only on programs like the folks are listening to right now, the sort of grassroots freelance internet programs where you'll get any kind of real Fourth Estate, honest Fourth Estate activity. I mean, do we have any problem naming the outlet and naming the individual that we're alluding to here?
Well, I generally don't do that. I'm that's kind of my personal code. I'm not
right.
A name caller, so I kind of hold off on that.
That's fine, but it's a very, very highly esteemed libertarian, conservative, constitutionalist website and outlet, and a big name that it takes from an individual's name, and they revealed themselves to be an asset of the mind control machine out of the central government. No two ways about it. You know, you submit an article for publication. You're the most widely read author on that website, and it not only doesn't get published, but they show up with a copy of it now. How smart do you have to be to figure out how the FBI would get an unpublished copy of your your article? So yeah.
Well,
we are on the reservation.
One of the things I was thinking about too, buddy, was in the course of our friendship, I do remember driving to Salt Lake City one weekend, and why don't you go into it for the folks? Had you not transported Clive and Bundy and some other folks to Salt Lake City for that program?
No, I didn't. I wasn't involved in the transportation of Cliven. I did drive up from Cedar City, where I was living, with one of his close associates. Her name, I'm embarrassed to say, escapes me right now, but she was the middle-aged gal, blonde-haired, who was in the truck
What's it?
Well, we're having a senior moment. I'm sorry?
Was it Cox?
Yeah, her last name, I think, was Cox. But Lavoy Finicum was driving, of course, the car. They came around a bend in, in deep winter, heavy snows accumulated all over the place. And our protectors in the Oregon State Police and in the hostage rescue team of the FBI decided to mess up the vehicle and stop it at a road stop, and she was in that vehicle. I transported on the day that you're talking about, which was months previous, with her, having no idea she was going to be involved in the Malheur protest. But I made her acquaintance and learned a lot about the Bundys, and then you, we were at a privately sponsored meeting, a public meeting, but privately organized, and of the Patriot community up here that came to see and hear Clive and Bundy. So that's where we got together for breakfast, you and Susanna and your wife and Cliven and some of his people. And we had a little serendipitous rendezvous there.
And also, I know that you were there. How about telling the folks a little bit about Lavoy's funeral, please, Dale?
Well, that was a tough, that was a difficult experience. I drove down. That was also, in wintertime. It was down in a part of extreme southern Utah near the Arizona border that's very difficult to get to. I mean, you can't just haul down there carefree on Route 15. You have to take either 89 or, well, that's not important, but it's tough to get to. Anyway, I drove down, and despite the fact that it was geographically pretty isolated place, there was a huge number of people there, including a lot of horses were brought in, trailered in at the end to take Lavoy out to the cemetery. I don't know what to tell you, Mike. I mean, it was gut wrenching. The widows there, the relatives, his adopted daughters, they all spoke, and there was quite a bit of police presence, which was totally unnecessary. I think the police were pretty passive, but the establishment down there acted like there might be trouble or something. I don't know how we could have made any trouble out in the prairie like that. But, my words fail a little bit on that, Mike, to be honest with you. But they had his tack and his boots there, and his mother and father are still alive, very aged. And they were very cheerful and very, very stout. And there were phenomenal speeches given, and if anybody could get their hands on the videotape of those the eulogy and the other remarks by the family, it would be well worth it.
Shauna Cox.
There you go. See, so much time's passed by. Very good. Yeah, that's Shauna. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she was a cool hand. She's on the recording as stuff is hitting, I think both bullets and probably non-lethal stuff is hitting the outside of the vehicle. Now, we're talking for folks who are a little at sea about what we're referencing, the Malheur Wildlife Refuge protest and that whole thing in Oregon where Lavoy ended up being shot by the Oregon State Police with an AR-10 from about 18 feet away, 15 feet away, three times. That's the episode we're talking about. And Shauna kept a cool head despite rounds, what certainly appeared to be rounds, hitting the pickup truck. And then, of course, Lavoie stepped out to try to, I think, put a stop to the thing and offer himself as a distraction because they had women in the vehicle when they had to stop at the roadblock.
I couldn't agree with that more, Dale. I think having talked with Lavoie, to me that was who he was. He recognized right away that they were taking gunfire, and he sought to separate himself from those women. And that, to me, was just that epitomizes the character of the man.
Yeah, that's the real deal. Yeah, that's the real deal. And a round, a 5.56 round, had already come down through the roof of the vehicle, close to where the bulkhead meets the top of the windshield, or the canopy, or whatever you call it. And so he knew what was going on. And that round apparently came from an HRT guy that was elevated. And I guess nothing became of that, huh? No big deal.
No, nothing became of that. That's true. And how about another thing I'd like for you to mention a little bit was our mutual friend, Will Grigg. Say a little bit about him, because, you know, that is such a loss in our community.
Right. So I talked to Will Grigg. He was a frequent guest on my program, and I talked to him privately many times. And I remember one episode where, he's a tough guy, ex-football player, big dude of actually a Polynesian descent, Pacific Islander. I can't remember what particular nation his folks came from, but he was adopted very young. I can remember the one time he got emotional was Family Services, the Department of Child and Family Services up there in Idaho, which has a terrible reputation for misdeeds and for getting the per capita federal benefit for all of the children they seize, like most of those departments. Anyway, he was being rousted by those folks, and I could tell he was stressed out. And I said to him, "You just remember, there's only one Will Grigg," and I meant it. When I said that, it wasn't just encouragement, and I could tell that it had an effect on him. And that's how I would respond to your bringing his name up. There is or was only one Will Grigg. I don't know another human being where you have an amalgam of writing skill, a virtuoso writer, plain spoken but brilliant writer, with the talents of an investigative journalist. And I don't know how he ever managed to get the inside stories that he did, with mostly around Idaho, the Idaho area there, just ordinary people like the cattle rancher who had a bull that had been hit by a car, and he was preparing to dispatch the bull, and a couple local police came out and shot him because he had a gun in his hand, I guess. And this guy had no police record in his whole long life and no arrest record. Cases like that, Will would get right in the middle of them, and also he would get deep into the corruption of local police departments. And you come away having read his work with an entirely different view of how municipal government works and how the corruption in city government, it's almost a guarantee that you're going to have funny business going on in these little governments and their police forces.
That was the Yankus family, wasn't it, Dale? After he was shot and killed by the cops who had come to get him to take care of a bull that had been hit, after they shot him and killed him, did his wife not have a heart attack?
I don't know, Mike. Don't know the answer to that one.
Yeah, his name was Jack Yantis, Y-A-N-T-I-S. I got into that, looking into that as well, and I believe that upon seeing that her husband had been shot and killed, she actually had a near-death heart attack type episode as well.
Yeah, that's the collateral. And TC, you probably remember Helen Chenoweth. That name rings a bell, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So you know.
Just so you know, Dale, did you know Red Beckman?
Oh, I know that name, but my almost 60-year-old brain ain't picking out the file for some reason.
Okay, Red was called the Fighting Montana. He ran for governor in Montana, and he and I did he was co-host with me on a show called Walls in Our Minds for about 10 years. That's how Mike and I met, was through Red.
That's a long run. You get to know somebody awful well in 10 years. I brought up Chenoweth, and I don't know if I'm cutting you off, TC, if you wanted to say something about Red.
No, I was just letting you kind of have an idea of where I've traveled over the last 12
years.
Yes.
Well, then you know the story of the Hages very, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. But Wayne Hage, you know that story. Hagee? You know the story of Wayne Hagee backwards and forwards, I'm thinking.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, the federal government wanted the Hagees to surrender a portion of their ranch, which was enormous, and they contrived all kinds of infractions to intimidate and to charge this ranch family with. But you mentioned a spouse dying of the stress. Wayne's wife, after having UH-60 helicopters land and, you know, in an air assault type of a posture on her property and various things like that, full of federal goons, she just dropped dead from it after a while. And that's how Helen Chenoweth and Wayne Hagee got together. And of course, Helen Chenoweth was the congresswoman, notable congresswoman, until she was killed in a car wreck. But there's a lot of that that goes on. There's more pets killed and more wives traumatized, and these are things people don't get over. Down where you were, Mike, that whole debacle with the military assault on the people in southeastern Utah because they own various Indian artifacts. That's a story a whole radio show could be built about. But you talk about doing tremendous collateral damage down there.
Oh, yes, most definitely. The thing that always amazed me about the Hagee trial was, I believe it was his son that kept pursuing that after both his mom and dad had passed. He kept pursuing it, and a judge in Nevada, a federal judge, just absolutely told the BLM that they had been involved in a criminal conspiracy for 10 years, and he threatened several of the people who had testified for the BLM. He threatened them with perjury charges, and he awarded the Hagee estate $3 million, and the federal government refused to pay it. So if the federal government can refuse to pay what a federal judge says, orders that they pay, why do we even worry with the federal judiciary at all?
Say again?
Look at Leo Wanta's case. Federal
Same
judge
thing.
Ordered the United States government to pay him, what was it, over $2 trillion, and he hasn't seen a nickel of it as far as I know.
And he's not going to.
Yeah, that I recall now that you mentioned, Mike, I recall that finding or that judgment, rather, by that federal judge and the language he used. He talked about the BLM as gangsters, you know, just scathing language in addition to the fine or whatever, or the award, and it doesn't amount to anything. They're free agents. I mean, the only time I think we've won that comes to mind here just off the cuff is maybe there's some other big wins, but Randy Weaver won some money. It's cold comfort, but nothing changed in terms of the culture of federal law enforcement. Nothing has changed, and it's, if anything, they've dug in and gotten worse.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that whatsoever, Dale. It has just been one incident after another, and I remember trying to take up the cause for some farmers and ranchers in southwest Colorado when the BLM had come in and said they were going to take 6 gallons per second of the water out of the irrigation feed for a valley in McElmo Canyon, actually. And they were going to take this, water away. 6 gallons per second is a lot of water. And they were going to take it away from the farmers and ranchers in the area, which would have been debilitating in anything but a bumper snow crop year. And we fought it in the court for like 2 years. And, you know, and it basically ended up a judge asked me finally, well, the first time we filed something and I filed it for them, I was told that I had no standing. So I had to go back and redo and what have you. And, I mean, we had some interviews with the BLM. They brought down the head guy for Colorado. They brought him down. And, you know, and we had meetings with the participants in the case on both sides. And I asked the head of the BLM for the state of Colorado, his last name was Smith at the time, I asked him, I said, did you not take an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States before you took your job? And he said, no, I didn't. And one of his aides punched him and said, yeah, you did. That was the kind of incompetence that, you know, that was taking place. And then finally, the judge asked me in one of the last hearings, said, what do you base your case on? And I said, U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, and the Constitution of the State of Colorado, Article 5, I forgot what number it was with them, because the Colorado Constitution says that the water in Colorado belongs to the people. And the government is not the people. And it's plainly stated in the Constitution, and I had a water court judge tell me that the Constitution didn't pertain to him.
So, wow. You know, stories like that are so far out seeming that I don't think they register with people, where you have these judges that, you know that they're really answerable to nobody, especially the appointed, the federal judges are, I mean, their only jeopardy is impeachment, if I recall.
And how many of those have happened?
None that I know of, except a couple of really gross, you know, really crooked buggers that were caught red-handed. But yeah, few and far between.
Well,
you have
I think
to just
was,
about be caught killing somebody.
Well, didn't they get one federal judge? I forgot what his name was, Algie Hastings. Did they not impeach him, and then he ran for Congress and won?
Yeah, I remember the name. I think he's passed away now. But, yeah, he had a checkered past when he got elected. I know that.
Well,
Mike, you might be able to speak to the whole Gloria Navarro thing. And I think that's another, for people who are just kind of tuning up on this subject of the, and the endemic corruption of the federal judiciary and the really bad business that they do in support of the alphabet soup agencies and protecting them. When they cut the Bundys, we're going back now to the beginning of the conversation, but you know, the Bundys just miraculously found themselves cut loose. I don't know if you guys want to say anything about that.
Well, first,
I'm springing it on you. I'm springing it on you, but we're doing that to each other, so all's fair, you know.
Okay, all right. Well, let me back up just a little bit and get the accurate information on the Hagee decision. I happened to been able to thumb through some stuff, and I found a document I had on that, and the judge said, and I quote, "In the present case, the organization, meaning the Bureau of Land Management, actions over the past two decades shocked the conscience of this court." And he said that if, let me see if I can find the rest of it. Anyway, the case was the estate of Wayne Hagee versus the United States. And it was, and the judge is U.S., Chief U.S. District Judge of Nevada, Robert C. Jones, was the one who made the ruling in that case, and he was the one that was completely ignored. He charged the BLM with, I quote, conspiracy to deprive a man of his private property, intimidating witnesses, and actions that would shock the conscience of my court. And he made those comments. They had like six BLM agents there set to testify. And after he charged the first three with perjury, the rest of them refused to testify. And you want to talk about just an absolute debacle, and that did not hit any major news media source at all. Imagine that.
Well, I wonder what became of that judge if he had a one-car accident or a early heart attack or something. That'd be interesting to look up. I recall also that Wayne's son went on. Wayne's son was so animated over this whole thing that he went on to get a law degree and pursue the feds in civil court, and he ended up losing after the whole years-long battle, and I don't know all the particulars.
Well, here is the thing. I hear so many people, guys, and I know I'm jumping ship here, but I hear so many people come up with these faulty ideas of saying, well, you know, there is a remedy for all of this if we just take it and take it through the federal courts and use the ammunition we have. I don't care how much you have. You're not going to do anything with these courts when the federal judges do the things like you mentioned Navarro. Navarro wasn't actually a judge, was she, Dale? Didn't they have to go into? Yeah, they had to pick her up. Yeah, they had to pick her up and bring her out and make her a judge because no other judges wanted to touch that case.
Well, that's a detail that escaped me. I do know that she's a Harry Reid operative, a toady of Harry Reid, and of course now you're getting into a gigantic can of worms with the Chinese and land appropriation and all kinds of dirty international treasonous business with the with Harry Reid and his son Rory. But the reason I brought up Judge Navarro is that you know, the idea of the rule of law is so absurd when you have a nation that's 3,300 miles wide. You know, you've got an empire. You don't have a nation. And not to get on the soapbox too high here, but the as soon as Gloria Navarro apparently got wind that there was an IG, that someone is out of the IG's office was going to have a problem with some of the procedures that she had allowed to go on with respect to testimony of federal law enforcement, she just dropped it. She just kicked them loose, and then that's a layman's version of what happened. If anybody wants to tune that up, that would be fine. But it just goes to show you, and I've seen it here in Utah, where the state government is trying to consume somebody, and all of a sudden they didn't realize that this person had connections of some kind, or had gained favor in with the general public as a victim, and all of a sudden you find out that there is a such thing as selective prosecution, you know, that they basically can cut anybody loose anytime they want to.
Oh, well, Terry, you
or
want
not,
to jump on that?
Or not.
Mostly
well,
not.
Navarro got schizophrenic at the end, and you know, it was obvious that something had happened that threatened her position in order for her to do that schizophrenic routine, because that was 180 degrees, man.
Wasn't
but now you look at, you want to talk about somebody in the federal judiciary, I don't know if there's a greater example than Sullivan. Sullivan has a track record of this kind of abuse.
Oh,
and what's going on now with Flynn is just beyond belief.
Well, he's back on the hook, they say.
Not really.
Not to the extent he was before, I suppose. But he's not quite as free and loose as he had hoped he would be.
Well, yeah,
there's a military. Yeah.
The prosecutors have backed off, and the judge has stepped in the role of prosecutor. I've never seen that happen before.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish
well,
I could. Yeah, go ahead.
That happened with the Branch Davidians, guys. In the trial in Texas, the jury found them innocent, and the judge sentenced them to prison anyway.
Oh, the old bait and switch. Man, you've got a heck of a memory, my friend. That is one of the most, gobsmacking examples of this thing we're trying to describe here this afternoon. I remember now, and he gave instructions that baited that jury, essentially, into the jury was left with the impression that they could make a decision, and that there wouldn't be that much jeopardy for the defendants. And then the judge just dropped a bomb. Once he had the guilty verdict from the jury, he reversed himself. And I wish I knew the details better, but it was horrendous.
Well, there is no doubt that we've scratched the surface of so many here, of just outward. I don't know. I really don't know the name to use for it, guys. This is we are living in a surreal world, and when we've got people running around, every time someone says the word justice, I get cold chills, because there is no justice in this country. I'll never forget Phoenix City, Alabama, one time, and I'm going to use a bad word here, guys. Please forgive me. At least a bad word in the phrase of the world. But this was in the early 1970s, and a local judge in Phoenix City, Alabama, said one of the people in his courtroom said something about justice. He said, young man, let me tell you something. If you want justice in America, he said, you go to the whorehouse. If you want to get screwed, come to the courthouse.
I've got an acquaintance who's a criminal defense attorney, and the balance of his cases are in federal court, if I understand it correctly. So it's an insight there to how they operate, and it's just a meat grinder. Once you're charged by the U.S. attorney for you in your district, I believe that's the proper term. You're done, except with rare exceptions, and you know. You guys know how it works. They hold 20 years of incarceration over your head, and the prospect of being bankrupted in paying for your legal defense. And as an alternative to that, they'll let you serve 4 or 5 years with you if you plead no contest. And this friend of mine, this attorney, says that it's a sausage factory. They just process people through that and send them to federal prison as streamlined as you could imagine. And it goes on day after day, every day. So there you go. And the feds go particularly go wild on people who try to make some kind of a constitutionally based defense, some kind of defense that's out of the ordinary and more of a sovereign citizen, constitutional, fundamental kind of legal defense. Those people, they go out of their way to send up for extra long sentences. And, you know, there's I can't recall names and dates and places, but I've heard the details of several individual cases that it,
or they take them out with psychotropic drugs like they did Edgar Steele.
Oh boy, well Ed Steele.
Wow, that's a whole new one.
Wow, I'll tell you what, man, we're hitting the heavies tonight. I almost feel like I knew Ed Steele. I got acquainted with who he was by an old gal. I say an old gal, it's not very nice, an older lady who was a fellow broadcaster at my the station I worked at here in Salt Lake, and she had the nerve to bring Edgar on as a guest about every couple months, and that guy was electrifying. He was another one of those guys where there's no substitute, there's no replacement. And so I talked to Edgar after he had his heart attack and was trying to book him for an interview. He felt like he wasn't strong enough yet. And then I read 2 days later, they raided him and ended up in Victorville, where you go to die. So Victorville Federal Prison in California.
And he did.
Pardon me?
And he did.
Like, oh, yeah.
He went there to die, and he did. That is just a case. There was a gentleman several years ago in Arkansas, up in the northwest part of Arkansas, and he, Hollis Wayne Fincher, and he had a case that was just absolutely unreal. And in a federal court in Little Rock, the federal judge told his defense attorney that they could not use the Constitution as a defense.
Yeah, I mean, it's stunning. How do you, when they're that bold, you know, the judges are on the alert for somebody that's going to come in with a Constitution, something that. An argument that compromises their authority, and they're already pissed off before it ever happens. I mean, they come unglued. And so what are judges? You know, what is really going on there? I have another acquaintance who's done research that says they're paid out of a slush fund that nobody will admit to.
They're beneficiaries of the tax of the taxing system, and therefore incapable of making an impartial decision or determination of fact. A lot of people have actually put them on notice by instruction of Red Beckman that
yes.
They present the Seventh Amendment, and they put the judge on notice that they are a beneficiary of the tax system, and therefore incapable of making an impartial decision and forced them to recuse themselves. That was one thing. The other thing is that they actually get payments into their retirement system based on convictions.
True.
So they benefit in multiple ways. But in addition to that, they would have never got into that position if they were not in some way compromised.
Well, that's certainly how the elected officials of the federal government have to roll. They have to be dirtied up before they're even considered as a nominee. But guys, I'll tell you one thing I wanted to touch on tonight, if I could for a minute. I sat here thinking for a few minutes before I called you. And I wondered what your reactions are to this this contact tracing thing, which has already gotten up on its hind legs in other countries really bad, and in the form of people waltzing into your house and executing tests for COVID-19 and lecturing you about staying apart in your own house and what have you. And I got to thinking, you know, this is the next phase of the war on drugs. I mean, the war on drugs eroded constitutional protections. They weren't too good to begin with, but the war on drugs knocked the crap out of the Fourth Amendment. And but this thing that they're setting up now, which has been in the works for decades, by all indications, is going to really take that threshold of your house and evaporate it. And the intimidating aspect of it is they have a lot of the population that will be cheering them on because of the terror related to the supposed risk of the virus. So I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, but I'm thinking I better get my bags packed here because I'm not going to take the shot and I'm not going to let anybody stick a straw down my nose either. And I don't know how that's going to play out, but it ain't going to happen.
My wife is a caregiver, and she's faced with that right now. They're just told people yesterday and the place that she works that they're all going to mandatorily have to be tested, and she's not going to be tested. The test is a fraud. We've talked about this some, Dale, but, Mike, you want to go first? You want me to jump in here a little bit?
Well, the only thing I'm going to say, and then I want you to jump on it like a chicken on a June bug, is the only thing I'm going to say is, what does it say on the bottom of the license tag in New Hampshire?
Yeah. Live free or die.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a shame. It's a shame that we got to have that in front of us in our later years. But life ain't fair, you know. So what are you going to do?
All right, Terry, jump on it, buddy.
Wow. Well, the contract tracers and brown shirts are there's quite literally no difference. The brown shirts in Germany were a test run, and we're dealing with the same people that fomented that whole situation. That's who we're dealing with right now. And you mentioned before the show about the genocidal nature of this. Let's just lay some facts out. I've laid them out before. I'll lay some facts out. A mask does nothing to stop a virus. But the question is it a virus? Because I don't know of a single pathologist who has associated these symptoms of inflammation and blood clotting with a virus. We've been told that it was a virus. There's not really any field evidence or testing that has isolated a virus in the field. I know one's been isolated in a laboratory, but they've isolated no virus in the field. And the tests do not isolate a virus. The tests are not for a virus. The test is a surrogate, amplified surrogate test for genetic material that happened to be present in some of the symptoms, in some of the people who were dying from this upper respiratory distress situation that was really caused by blood clotting or the iron being stripped out of the blood so that it could not pick up the oxygen from the lungs. And the pathologists that have observed this stuff, not a single one of them have associated it with a virus. They have associated it with inflammation of the bacterial condition, other side effects, but they've also said that the inflammation could have been caused by 5G. 5G was turned up in Wuhan 2 weeks before those people that really kind of started this whole thing in Wuhan died. 5G had been turned up there. That was the first place in the world for it to be turned up. The place in Italy where they had the high concentrations of deaths was also a heavy electromagnetic field by 5G. And the pathologist in Italy that went against the World Health Organization and went against the advice to cremate these people, they autopsied 100 people, and they didn't identify any of the symptoms of any of those 100 people with the virus. They identified the blood clotting that they found throughout the body and the inflammation with bacteria that had been inflamed by electromagnetic field. That's what the pathologist in Italy said. So we're sitting here with a test that does not test for a virus. Now, if they haven't isolated a virus in the field, how can they come up with a vaccine if they haven't even isolated a virus in the field? I mean, this whole thing is a scam. It's a lie. We've been lied about all these other things, and they're lying to us totally about this and right now. So you look at these places, just like my county right now, is one of the most conservative counties probably in the whole United States. And our county commissioners just approved a contract to bring in a mobile testing group into our county. And they think the solution is to do more testing. The only thing that testing does is increase the false positives so that they can fraudulently create data to support the whole pandemic. What this test does, it's like one doctor, I forget his name, it wasn't Kaufman, I think it was Tom, I don't remember his last name, I'm sorry, but anyway, he was an immunologist, and he compared this testing with trying to figure out how many feet there were in a town by looking at how many shoestrings were sold. The way that this testing works is that everybody, just like everybody has a little bit of cancer, and you're producing right. hypochlorous acid in your body, and it controls it. And if you're not producing enough hypochlorous acid in your body, then you start getting enough of the cancer that'll show up in the test. So with this genetic material that they're testing for, they're testing for RNA. They're not testing for virus. So what happened is that they have to amplify the results. The doctors have stated that this particular testing has at least a 50 to 80% false positive. Well, they're amplifying almost everywhere on a 30 on an exponential amplification of 30. And if they go to 40, which some of them do, guess what? You get a 100% positive result on the test. And
well,
some
that
of
would
the labs
explain
in Florida, that's really what's happening.
That would explain how tissue from a goat could test positive, or from a tangerine or something like. I mean, there's been a lot of non-human things tested.
The president of Tanzania sent in a piece of tropical fruit, a test off of a piece of tropical fruit and a goat, and they both came back positive.
Did you, TC, did you happen to hear, before he was pretty much stifled, I haven't seen him in the last couple of weeks, but some of the statements that the president of Ghana came out with, big, husky, black man, tremendous presence, deep voice, talking about what this thing is all about?
No, not Ghana. Maybe
yeah,
I did see something, but I...
You'd remember, because he makes this dude makes an impression, and he's not apologizing to anybody for anything. And he says he addressed himself in particular to the heads of state in Africa, that this is a Bill Gates, Big Pharma, and we know that those are only, Gates is just a front man ultimately for the central banks, that that's another can of worms. But this guy is very switched on, and he said, don't take the vaccine. And if you're in authority, stop the vaccine from coming into your country, because it's just a population reduction mechanism. It's a hustle. The coronavirus is a common cold is a coronavirus, is it not?
A form, yes.
Yeah. So I mean, the kind of tests that they're doing, there's no legitimate claim that it could verify the presence of something as specific as COVID-19. In any case,
the guy that invented the test, the man who actually created this test, stated specifically that this test is not suitable for testing an infectious disease. Those were his words.
Right. Now, we had a report come out this week. Don't have my notes at hand here on it, but I didn't take notes, but it's something you could find on the internet, a report on the death rate in the United States in 2020. And of course, we're only 7.5 months. What are we? Yeah, 7.5 months through 2020. But they take how many people have died in the United States and they extrapolate out that number to 12 months. And the death, the rate of folks dying in this country is lower than it was last year and the year before.
Specifically, if you look at the pneumonia deaths, the average level of pneumonia deaths currently is 1,500 less per week than normal.
Mm. Well, and
1,500
less
per week than normal.
What would account for that?
Because they're calling everything COVID. It doesn't matter. If you die, you die of COVID.
So you take from one basket and put it in the COVID basket. Yeah.
If you're a hospital administrator and somebody dies and you would normally get a check for $6,000, but if you label it COVID, you get a check for $36,000, what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's what
you're
going to
take.
Those are real numbers.
You take the guy that got in a motorcycle wreck and you make sure he was a COVID patient. That's what you do.
Hey, guys, here's something that has always, especially since I started looking into this about 5 years ago. According to Johns Hopkins University, 685 people a day die in this country from preventable medical errors.
Mm-hmm.
So far exceeds any of these figures they're coming up with. So if it's that high, and according to Johns Hopkins University, it could be almost twice that. So if we're losing that many people to preventable medical errors, why isn't there some kind of huge push to stop that pandemic?
Well, yeah, we know the answer to that. I mean, money talks and BS walks. It's you're not going to get any reform coming up out of the medical and big pharma sectors because they're running that's the fox is running the hen house, right? I mean, who would you call? Would you call call your senator or congressman who can be unseated by the pharmaceutical industry next election? Yeah, there is nobody in the United States. There's nobody to call.
Well, here was a point I made the other day, guys, and I think this is a valid point. I don't normally watch television, but if you turn on television and you watch 2 hours of programming, how many ads are you going to see for new drugs, some kind of new drug, everything from, toenail fungus to baldness? There is some kind of new drug out there, but then you look at the side effects. And the reason you can't sue a drug company for killing you or killing someone that's a family member or anyone else is because they tell you up front that they give you all of these side effects and all these things that can happen. Well, if that is the, if those people are the people coming up with a vaccination, why should we trust them?
Well, I don't know, Mike. I retrench to my all-purpose theory on questions like that, which is it doesn't matter what the informed people think. It matters what the dumb people think, because the dumb and the ignorant, because they're vastly more numerous. So if you can steer the herd, it doesn't matter who's complaining, you know?
Well, all you got to do is mention the C word if you want to get demonetized. You know what the C word is?
I'm gonna take a wild guess. Go ahead.
C-U-R-E. C-U-R-E.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
That's the C word. If you mention it, you're going to be demonetized or investigated or something, because that's not what Big Pharma ever wants. They want to be able to treat the symptoms indefinitely and make billions of dollars per year off of it. Because if anybody C-U-R-E's anything, like taking sodium chloride and activating it with citric acid and producing a dioxide gas and consuming that so that it wipes out all the pathogens in your system. If you do something like that, which ends up C-U-R-E, whatever is ailing most people, it will put them out of business. And so that is now criminalized for anybody to even mention that anything could cause a C-U-R-E.
You go down the rabbit hole on this medical thing far enough to get back to the turn of the century and just before, and once again, when you look at the systematic way that what we call alternative medical disciplines were suppressed, brutally suppressed, and are still brutally suppressed for those who are free enough spirit to try to challenge allopathic medicine. But you go back and watch the way that the families connected to the European central banks, the Rockefellers and what have you, systematically eliminated any kind of therapeutic approach that would compete or put the lie to any of these things you're describing 120 years ago, 130 years ago. It kind of puts the zap on your head, because you realize you're dealing with an entity that is in a long arc of planning, and that, again, the box we're in is so much more disciplined than even people who try to educate themselves on the subject, like myself, I suppose, you know, lay people who are just do their own pet course of study on these patterns. It's so much worse than we know. And you become very isolated in the world. And I'm sure you guys have felt this and experienced this, because unless you go back and look at this old documentation where they crushed frequency therapies and so many other things that are very productive with respect to human health, it would be, unless you had taught yourself the facts, very hard in spoken English and in just a normal discourse with people day to day to convey to them how diabolical this thing is and how long arc, like I say, long arc, and and otherworldly genius involved. And that's where I usually end up, is that I'm not religious, but that you can't believe that the people, the entities pulling the strings with this stuff are purely in the third dimension, you know, that there's got to be some kind of off-world interaction here. But that, again, is another can of worms and probably a subject for another show.
Well, I'm a follower of scripture deeply, Dale, and I have no question that there is otherworldly bloodlines that, and I don't mean extraterrestrial. I actually mean coming from a different plane, if you will. I believe in the Nephilim, and I believe that there are those who are mighty men that have been produced from the interaction between fallen angels and the demonic and humans. So we could certainly go there on a show, and be glad to try to put one together with you on that. That would be a fun show, but I don't think we want to try to handle that in the next 15 minutes. So
yeah, no, it's a fascinating subject. I'm sure you probably have heard people like Tom Horn and Steve Quayle and Dave Hodges, and there's sort of this coterie of internet radio folks that touch on that subject from time to time. But then there's go ahead.
I've heard all of those men, and I don't agree with everything that they come out with, but they certainly touch on some things that are real.
But you know, for people who just have a stumbling block with this idea of the unseen world giving such orchestration and coordination to these things that we're trying to describe today, you know, they might want to take a look at the practices of the elite in their religion, you know, their religious practices, because they have no such stumbling block, and it's quite evident from people who have escaped their clutches, because their religion involves the victimization of children and the drinking of blood, you know, when children are in a terrified state and they're having all kinds of adrenal.
Dale, there's a common thread. There's a common element to the banksters, to the Jesuits, the Talmudic Kabbalist. The common thread that ties them all together at the esoteric level, they pray to Lucifer, all of them.
Yeah, no, that's it. And I graze fairly. I don't go and drill real deep on these subjects, but I listen to people who do, for what it's worth, and the Kabbalists, or you know, the Kabbalah, for example, I have acquaintances who have drilled very deeply into that. There is no monotheistic God in sight when you get down into the core of that thing. That has nothing to do with, it has nothing to do with the God of the Old Testament or anything else. And that's the shadowy connection, TC, that you alluded to, is that these folks all, they may be in different compartments, but they're all practicing the same core religion, and they are the authority on the earth. And I think we can take a certain amount of solace in that, because I know, talking to Mike, Mike and I, in a similar fashion, get very vexed, frustrated about how our fellow humans are responding to this imminent crisis, you know, where they're going to bum rush.
Let's call it what it is. Let's call it what it is. It's not a pandemic. It's a satanic ritual. It is mind control.
Mm-hmm.
It is trying to reset the people's minds. It's isolating people. It's dumbing them down by cutting their oxygen level. you can't even get accurate change from a cashier these days who's wearing a mask mm-hmm. because they can't think that well. They're dumbed
right.
down that much. And that's what this whole process is really about. It's about controlling the people, and it's actually participating in the same sort of things that go on in satanic rituals. That's where they employed the mask. That's why they know how to use it. That's why they came down with this system to get everybody wearing them, so that they could control them, they could dumb them down, and isolate.
Yeah, it's the entry level. It's the entry level compliance, act of compliance. What, by the way, what do you guys see when you get out and about in where you're living in terms of compliance with the mask?
You want me to go, Mike?
Yeah, go ahead, buddy.
Obviously, when you get into public environments, it accelerates. But I'm out in people's homes all over a multi-county region doing construction estimates. And what I'm seeing is only about 1 out of 6 households carrying about a mask on their own. So, but they comply when they go into an environment where they're required. If they go to Costco or in Supers or, you know, a Safeway, wherever the stores, and the only way they get through the door without being hassled is to put on a mask. 95% of them will put on a mask. But outside of that environment, they recognize that the mask is useless and that it's more political and spiritual than it has to do with health. That's what I'm seeing.
Well, Terry, I got a question, guys. Who has failed this country more, as I listen to what you gentlemen are saying, and you nailed it, you've hit it right upside the head. It's a satanic influence. Who has failed this country more than the churches?
I can think of some people who are equivalent, but not more. The churches are definitely, the pulpit is definitely not doing its job.
Well, Mike, we've come a long way from Father Coughlin.
Oh, big time! Yeah,
and that was not actually that was not a natural or an organic organic process. You've got billions of dollars. And this is one of those things where people say, prove it, show me the basis of your opinion, document something, you know, do it yourself, take it for what it's worth. Billions have flooded into North America to steer the mainline churches, the mainline Protestant sects, over into the cultural Marxism sort of profile, and also to venerate the state of Israel as a fulfillment of prophecy, and to sort of put up a kind of a Teflon coating around everything Israeli and everything that has to do with organized Jewish interests in the globe. It's such that, you have a tremendous Christian Zionist component to the body politic here, and it almost makes getting to the Judeo part of the Judeo-Masonic problem that we alluded to earlier, it makes it almost impossible. There's just too much. You got a giant biomass standing in your way, and Pastor Hagee and all the rest of them. That costs billions of dollars to do that over decades, and it was beautifully executed. So,
well, very much so. I could not agree more. But, the other day I saw just the epitome of insanity to me was a woman driving down the highway by herself in her car with a mask on with a bumper sticker that said, "Faith, not fear."
Oh, my gosh. You're not going to top that one. For a while yet. Yeah, that's a stunning thing. I you know, I did this sort of dissident type of radio broadcasting out of Salt Lake City for 12 or 13 years, and I thought I got kind of jaded or, you know, cynical about how bad the ordinary folks, their level of awareness. I mean, this sounds real high and mighty. I don't mean it to sound that way, but I witnessed so many staggeringly stupid things happen, and the herd backing it up, and there's a lot of very peculiar type of corruption having to do with the dominant religion out here, and it's sort of the power behind the curtain, to say the least. But even I have been stunned by the way people wear these masks. That's really why I just wanted to get the kind of the gut reaction from you guys, because I got to admit, it has been discouraging. I go again and again, I'll go in to buy food in the grocery store, and I'm the only knucklehead that isn't wearing the thing, and I'm getting double and triple takes and the skunk eye and everything else. And I think, you know, man, there can't, you know, there's 200, maybe 300 people in this building. There can't be one other, you know, stubborn person. I don't get it. And then I naturally then think of when they start their compulsory vaccination, and I have to admit, it's a pretty beleaguered thing that's coming into view here. At least that's my perception.
Terry, how much time do we have?
8 minutes. 9 minutes.
Hey, Dale, we've got enough time. Would you give the folks, the listeners, would you give them a rundown on I wanted you to do this, and I forgot about it earlier. Would you give the people a rundown on your encounter with Antifa a while back?
Yeah. I'm getting so punchy, and I like to tell people I turn 60 next month, so I get sympathy. But it was 2 years ago. I can't remember. It was about 2 years ago, and a friend. Actually, it was that same attorney who defends people in federal cases. He called me complaining that nobody was joining him in showing a conservative presence down in this downtown, very Marxist zone where they have in Salt Lake City, where there's thousands of lefties will turn out. And so I kind of naively said, oh, I'll come down and watch your back, you know. So we went down there, and there was a big demonstration, thousands and thousands of people demonstrating about the girl who was killed during the protests in Virginia, in Charlotte, I believe it was Charlottesville. The girl had a heart attack, and some people say she was hit by a car. But anyway, they're up on their hind legs over that. So went down there. And I noticed that there was immediately a kid about 19 in a hoodie that was standing literally within a yard of my friend and I as he bullhorned and, you know, tried to promote family values or whatever. So I said to my friend, I think we're going to get formed. And that's what the kid was doing. He was keeping the GPS. A GPS reading on us so that the Antifa that were scattered in the crowd could swarm us. And so my friend, I was filming him, and I had my head down more than I normally would, watching the device I was videoing him with, and I couldn't see him in the viewfinder anymore. I looked up, and he was gone without warning, and I was surrounded by, you know, I don't know how many. 40 black-clad people. I could see three or four sawed-off aluminum baseball bats right amongst them, and the ones that were in front. And I backed up against a granite block wall, and they didn't start wailing on me. They did rip some printed material out of my hands, and of course I was armed like every day. But I knew quite instinctively that the only interest law enforcement would have in this incident, because Salt Lake is communist, just flat out communist, would be if I produced a handgun. And if I fired that handgun, forget about it. I would be in the hole for whatever life I have left. I'd be in the hole. So I walked away, turned my back on them, and they clustered around me and threw a lot of very nasty language at me, but they didn't throw me a beating. Fortunately, I got up to the city library where they decided they didn't want to come inside, and we waited for the cops. My friend was already up there, and took the cops 43 minutes to arrive. It turns out one of the passersby, maybe a couple of them among the lefty crowd, actually videotaped the thing, but the Salt Lake City police, they don't want anything to do with it. So there you go. I don't know if that was sufficient, but that's the visceral part of being surrounded by 40 people and realizing that if they start wailing, you know, you have no chance. That part, you have to experience that to appreciate it, you know.
Well, this is something that I have told people, and I actually had a sheriff in Arkansas tell me that he believed this was true, is that the local police from some national level have been told to leave Antifa and BLM alone. And I think that is becoming more and more prominent.
I mean, it's again, here is another one of those things. If we feel around the elephant as a blindfolded person long enough, we begin to see, you know, there's a massive shape there. We already knew that the intel agencies are putting their people, middle grade retired officers from the military, now working for CIA, into sheriff's departments, a lot of times as the undersheriff, but having their tentacle in every local law enforcement. We knew that a long time ago. But, yeah, money's changing hands. And Antifa is a mercenary army to begin with, as you both know. But they have a get-out-of-jail-free card. You bet they do, absolutely, in many, many cities. And we're going to see it manifest shortly.
Well, I still believe, guys, and I'm not ashamed to say it, I still believe that Antifa and BLM is a CIA-run operation.
Well, why not, Mike? I mean, what is the CIA but the muscle for the central bank? They are the enforcers. I mean, when they had – TC probably knows all about this, but when they went from being the OSS to the CIA, they had a Luciferian occultic – ceremony, a very elaborate ceremony during that inaugural, you know, process. So, yeah.
Also remember that Operation Paperclip, we brought some Nazis, SS people over and put them into what became the CIA. So we have that as a figurehead from the very beginning as well.
Thanks to Prescott Bush and the Dulles boys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, the Dulles boys took care of the President of the United States when he was saying the wrong things and talking about maybe helping out the common man a little bit. Took care of him real quick, didn't they?
Well, they did on many levels, and he was not only talking. JFK was doing things, so. You know, he put us back on the gold standard, Executive Order 11110, and then we had, he was pulling the troops out
silver,
of Vietnam.
That was silver certificates. That was silver certificates
right.
He was putting out.
Right.
It was not that many of them, but it was an incredibly significant act, symbolic act, enough alone to get him killed, I would say.
Well, here's one of the things that always struck me, guys, and I saw this in the Library of Congress, I forgot the number, but Kennedy had issued an order, and it had a number with it, that was the order to bring all of the troops home out of Vietnam. And he had a one-year timetable to bring them all out. the first order of LBJ on the plane on the way back from Dallas to Washington was to issue another order rescinding that previous order. But the thing that really got to me when I looked at it in the Library of Congress is the order that LBJ issued was written the day before. The date on it, the date of origin, was the day before the assassination.
Bada bing. Yeah. Well, just look at the Huey helicopter alone. 5,000 units destroyed in Vietnam. So what was that worth to Bell Textron?
And right before that, Bell Textron had bought out all of the other helicopter manufacturers. So then look at the same thing with look at how many people were making M14s. And so it was really spread out. But when they went to the M16, there was only one company, and that was Colt. There are so many tentacles to that thing; it's incredible.
It was really it was 100 or more interest. You know, who knows how many? But there were so many interests that aggregated to come together for the assassination. And sad. But
gentlemen, we are out of time, and we didn't open this with a prayer. We always get a prayer out of this show. Mike, could I ask you to close us in prayer?
Well, you sure can, Terry. And
thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate you being here with us, Dale.
I've enjoyed making your acquaintance and would like to meet you in person sometime, TC.
All right, guys.
Just outside of Denver, Colorado.
My prayers are usually just conversations with God. I don't do a very formal thing, but anyway. Dear Lord, really want you to take your hand and put it on this country and help us find a way out of the tragic mess that we're in. And because I believe, and I firmly believe this, that the only way out of this at this present time is with your intervention. And so I ask this in Jesus' name. I thank you also for Terry and for Dale, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with our audience. And I pray all of this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Good one, man.
Amen. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night, Jerry.
The armies of the Lord picked up and dusted off their swords, vowed to set the captive free and not let Satan have one more. What if the church, for heaven's sake, finally stepped up to his feet?